Order. And today we're going to be focusing mostly on, basically on transmission. And hearing from the various proponents about what is working out there and what isn't working, and in an effort to help us identify if there's further legislation that's necessary in order to support the appropriate amount of transmission out there. Mr. Fuller was not occupied this summer because the legislature was gone, and he was kind enough to do kind of a study on what we've done in the area of transmission in recent years, and I'd like to go over that with you just as a background. First, there was streamlining of the regulatory process to provide for regulatory efficiency and alternative approval for transmission. The routing process was streamlined in 2001, and an alternative state transmission planning process was created that would eliminate the certificate of need process. The routing approval process was transferred from the Environmental Quality Board to the Public Utilities Commission in 2005, so that both the certificate of need and routing approval authority was vested in the same agency. In 2005, legislation was passed allowing cost recovery for public utility transmission investments so as to make transmission investments more financially attractive. Cost recovery was required to be fair to utility customers. There have been several laws passed requiring planning for and constructing transmission necessary to accommodate increased generation installed to comply with the renewable energy standard. This included various studies such as wind integration studies. Planning for transmission for renewable generation was required in the alternative state transmission plan process. In 2005, regional needs were authorized to be considered when the PUC considers a certificate of need application for transmission facilities. And also in 2005, the need for a robust transmission system was authorized to be considered in a certificate of need application. So I see we have a quorum at this time, or do we? I think we're still one short. One, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, one more. We do have minutes from our last meeting, which we will approve as soon as we do have a quorum here. But I think we'll begin. There are some people that have some other obligations, and so I think we'll begin with our panel of presenters. And the first will be, I'm calling David Boyd, Chair of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, Mariah White, Manager of Energy Regulation and Planning and Energy Facilities Permitting, State Energy Office, Office of Energy Security, and Jennifer Curran is the Director, Transmission Asset Management from Midwest, from MISO. And we have a quorum. I would, just before you start, I'd ask members to review their minutes, and when we get a break here, I'll entertain a motion to approve them. So who would like to start? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chairs Pretner, Solon, and Hilty, and members of the Commission, my name is David Boyd. I am the Chair of the Public Utilities Commission, and I'm happy to be here with quite a number of folks to participate in this conversation about the issues surrounding transmission. Transmission is one of the more complex topics we're all working on, and one that will require the participation and cooperation of all the parties to succeed. As you've requested of us, we've assembled presenters who play distinct and different roles in the many facets of transmission policy. We've been asked to provide an update and an overview of transmission in Minnesota and some of the policies that are being pursued, which is a significantly large topic to be presented in a short period of time. We've organized our presentations, and we'll hop back and forth a little bit to try and be as efficient as we can. I think you might want to think of our presentation as sort of a buffet table. We're going to offer you a variety of goodies, a bite at a time, and it's quite likely you're going to want to come back for more information and a second helping, and we'd certainly be happy to do that today or in the future as at your discretion. I think before we begin, at least for my sake, some historical context to the issue of transmission will be helpful. So if you indulge me, I'd like to begin by describing the way we were, or how transmission, construction, planning, and cost allocation was performed historically, and historically was not so long ago. It's just a matter of a few years. Then we'll move on to the impacts of federal action authorizing participation in regional transmission organizations, organized electricity markets, and finally the impacts associated with the integration of renewable energy.
Good.
These two events have changed the transmission picture in profound ways, and we'll try to highlight how transmission planning has changed with these perturbations and describe the different groups working on planning from a state-based perspective on through an eastern interconnection-based perspective. And then for dessert, we'll serve up a bit of a discussion on issues where the transition from the old to the new has led to some particularly acute growing pains. So this first slide is a horribly oversimplified picture of how a vertically integrated utility would look from days gone by. Here, a utility with a defined service territory would provide service to its customers. The utility would add generation, transmission, and distribution facilities as needed, sized to the needs of the customer. The utility would fund the construction of these facilities, and the traditional cost allocation questions are of who's causing the cost to be imposed and who benefits from the construction. These are questions that are rather easily answered because the customers within the service territory are both. And the jurisdiction for overseeing electricity transmission projects in this manner, generation and transmission, are within the regulatory bounds of the state of Minnesota, unlike natural gas, which has always been deemed an interstate commodity and therefore falls under federal jurisdiction. There were no open energy markets not too long ago, a few years ago, but bilateral transactions with other utilities were possible. If the purchase or sale of electricity was needed or desired, this could include provision of reserve requirements for reliability purposes, but could also cover purchasing power when a generating station was unavailable, energy to cover peak demand days, sales of excess generation, and so on. If there was excess power generated with no buyers, that excess generation would essentially go to waste, or the capacity would go to waste. Again, decisions related to the sizing of facilities was within the purview of the two utilities in this diagram. The cost causers and beneficiaries were the customers within these two service areas. So again, cost allocation was reasonably simple and straightforward. And I, before we go on, Jennifer Curran, I would like to mention Claire Moeller was to be here, and he is experienced a family matter of some significance, and if you know Claire, you know he would love to be here today, and we're very fortunate to have Jennifer stepping in on extraordinarily short notice.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'll do my best to fill his shoes. As we turn the discussion to transmission planning now, the point to consider is that there's a series of orders from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that govern actions such as the energy market, maintaining system reliability, the creation of regional transmission organizations, of which the Midwest ISO is one, in Order 2000. There's been a subsequent order that goes even to more in-depth into transmission planning protocols and cost allocation. So as we think about the question of transmission planning and cost allocation, the way the Midwest ISO approaches those are governed by the rules that are in our FERC-accepted tariff. Excuse me. When you think about utility service provision now, this is another simplified diagram, but that's really intended to show is now you have that you have market forces and public policy forces at play now. So a utility might be building generation to meet a renewable renewable energy standard. It might be looking to sell excess energy into the market. As we look at the design of transmission, it is not just to maintain the reliability of the grid or of the local area, but perhaps looking at the whole grid, or perhaps looking at other reasons altogether for transmission. Again, the integration of renewables is certainly a key factor that we look at today. Are there ways to use transmission to reduce market costs and make the cost of power more reduced and make that market more efficient? So there are now a number of reasons as utilities consider resource and transmission planning, and with the work of and in conjunction with the Midwest ISO, that we may see transmission being built. And that comes into play as we think about how we would cost share those types of products.
In order to meet our state renewable energy standards while maintaining our reliability standards, most stakeholders agree that we need to invest in more transmission capacity in Minnesota. The current rules, which predate our RES and the Midwest ISO, raise difficult questions about who will pay for that new transmission, and that, I think, is at the heart of some of the conversations that are ongoing now. It's fairly well known and recognized that no significant amount of transmission has been built in the state, or the region or the nation for that matter, in the last few decades. So even if no new public policies had been enacted to change our generation mix, or if no open energy market had been developed, we would still need new transmission to accommodate today's increasing reliance on electronic gadgets and gizmos and toys, much less in anticipation of some potentially significant policy changes like plug-in hybrid electric vehicles that might shift some of the transportation sector energy into the electricity sector.
Dr. Boyd.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
As you're talking about this, because I think this is a key issue about do we need more transmission or don't we need more transmission? As you're talking about this, I'm wondering if you would weave in also our recent policy about conservation and energy efficiency and whether that will have an impact and particularly the type of transmission lines we might need if we're moving more toward renewable sources of energy.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think those are some of the little puzzle pieces that are highlighted inside this particular image. The process of trying to look forward to transmission planning is significantly more complex than it once was, and some of the reasons include energy efficiency, demand side management, distributed generation, reliability standards, actual operability issues with the grid, with intermittent renewables, congestion, and the like. Absolutely, I think that what the conservation policies are important. They're significant. They're being modeled as best they can inside all of the scenarios that are being looked at. And they do tend to lessen the magnitude of the need, but in terms of the studies that have been brought to the commission, not all of them, but a lot of them do show still an increased need for transmission. And some of it's geography. If you think about the Buffalo Ridge area, when transmission was constructed, it was designed to take care of small towns and rural farmsteads. Now we're trying to move fairly significant amounts of energy from that area toward population centers, and the grid was never designed to do that sort of thing. So some of these are geographic issues that are played out in the state and then broadly across the country. The same scenarios exist in other states and other parts of the country. Our planning today is informed by a lot of issues, including those you described. The old rules with clearly identified cost causers and beneficiaries are not well suited to this new paradigm. Stated another way, today's public policy requirements and the public's interest in renewable generation blurs the traditional model of transmission cost allocation, where the utility builds for its customers and those customers pay for the improvements. Today's open access market further complicates these questions as the market broadens the area over which utilities buy and sell electricity and distributes benefits. So the old rules are not suitable to our expansion. The new rules don't yet exist. However, the good news is the utilities, regulators, and stakeholders are working to try and solve these problems. And now I think we'll take a little time to run down a quick list on some of the planning and funding efforts that are currently taking place.
Sharon, before I talk a little bit about the specific planning efforts, I want to talk a little bit about approach to transmission design, particularly in an era where public policy is changing with regard to environmental impacts, for example. We take still the general approach to transmission study. We want to maintain system reliability, minimize the capital cost that has to be spent to meet energy needs, and minimize the ongoing system energy costs. But we find that solution is often subject to a competing goal. Some would like to minimize investment risk. Some of this transmission that I'll be talking about later, high voltage transmission, has a 40-year accounting life and a significantly longer physical life. There's a fair amount of risk in adopting that type of plan from a financial perspective. The question of carbon reduction: is the goal to replace coal production in the near or long term? That could be at odds with the question of maintaining a lower system energy cost. A question of local economic development: is the goal for wind generation to have it located in the state, or to just have access to that renewable energy source? And then finally, of course, what is the lowest cost to the consumer? And as we look at the transmission studies, we're trying to provide the information about these trade-offs to see the impacts of the various choices. At the Midwest ISO, we are engaged in planning from the regional to the national level. We have a study going on currently called the Regional Generation Outlet Study. It's divided into two parts, looking at both the western states and the Midwest ISO, and then at the eastern, ultimately resulting in a combined view that's looking to see what transmission is needed just to meet the renewable energy standards that exist in the Midwest ISO today. In our ongoing transmission planning process, we regularly look at questions like what transmission would be needed to meet a 20% federal renewable energy mandate, for example. The Joint Coordinated System Plan is a study that takes that type of questions one step further and asks, what if you were looking to meet that level of renewable energy across the whole eastern part of the United States? And in conjunction with that, we would look at wind integration and transmission studies that look not just at the transmission planning component in the system, reliability from a transmission perspective, but also from an operating perspective. As you increase your amount of wind generation, which is a more variable wind output, how do we keep the reliability of the power source that consumers have come to expect? As we execute our planning, we're continuously working across anywhere from a 1 to 20-year horizon. At any given moment, we're answering specific requests from generators through our generator interconnection queue, seeking to connect to the grid and looking to understand what transmission is needed to allow them to interconnect reliably. At the same time, And those requests may be result in smaller transmission upgrades scattered all across the Midwest ISO. At the same time, we're using studies like the Regional Generation Outlet Study to take a more aggregate view to try to find the most economic solution to address the public policy or reliability concerns that are being sought. We use a plan that's an interregional plan, such as the Joint Coordinated System Plan, as a roadmap, if you will, to help provide guidance on the decisions that are being made in the near term, so that as we do look to meet our interim goals, we are not eliminating our ability to meet our long-term goals from a transmission planning perspective. The Regional Generation Outlet Study Phase 1 is the component that involves Minnesota. The transmission analysis and design is underway, as well as looking at transmission designs that would support the Minnesota and other states nearby, providing wind generation to the eastern part of the footprint for those states to meet their renewable mandates. That preliminary transmission plan is available, and there will be a report published later this year. Just for your information, the Regional Generation Outlet Study has gone about a process of selecting renewable energy zones, which would be areas from a transmission design perspective that we would be seeking to develop this integrated transmission. It's worth noting that these zones don't preclude generation and wind or renewable generation from being developed elsewhere outside of these zones. It's also probably worth knowing that these zones are developed to integrate an additional 15,000 megawatts of wind in Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa, so they don't reflect the 1,800 megawatts of wind generation already in the state of Minnesota. As we look at what's going to be required for increased transmission build, the first point is the business case has to be there. This transmission needs to have the business case that it is doing what is being requested, whether it's renewable integration, maintaining reliability, lowering energy cost. Increased consensus around regional energy policy helps, and we'll hear some more about some of those efforts going on in a minute. A tariff that matches who benefits with who pays over time is really a fancy way for saying we've got to figure out the cost allocation question and who will pay for this transmission. And the final question is about cost recovery that allows those who do seek to build this transmission appropriate expectation of cost recovery commensurate with the risk they're undertaking, particularly given the long asset life.
You had asked specifically about things that are working. I think Mariah will pick up some topics within the state, but I wanted to tell you about two planning processes or projects that are underway in various stages before we move too long, and they are regional in nature. Increasingly, these questions stop being Minnesota-centered questions, and they become broader integrated questions. State regulators have become more involved in these processes all around the country. Our obligation to see that reliable, reasonably priced electricity is provided to ratepayers drives some of our involvement. The new regionalized and federal policies and state initiatives leave the PUC or the OES as suitable agents to represent Minnesota's interests in these conversations. In the case of the UMTDI, we were tasked as a commission or as five states worth of commissions to begin to become involved. In other cases, like this Eastern Interconnection project, the second one listed here, regulators chose to be proactive and fill a planning void that could not or would not be filled by other stakeholders. And I think the idea is that the regulators are routinely trying to balance conflicting interests, much the way legislators do. And if we can bring the skill set that lets us do our work within the state to multi-state problems, then we think we're well positioned to get some things done. And I think Jennifer hit the nail on the head with some of these issues: differing natural resources among states, differing environmental policies among states. Some states are retail choice, some are not. Some states have ordered divestiture of generation and transmission facilities, others have not. The list goes on and on. There are great numbers of differences among the states, and those differences need to be brought into conversation, and cooperatively some agreements need to be made in order to advance some of the questions on regional transmission. In the case of the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiative, that's a sub-regional planning process that the governors of Minnesota, Iowa, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin initiated almost just about a year ago. The goal of that group is to prioritize renewable generation zones sufficient to meet the needs of the five states, identify transmission needed to deliver energy to load, and address cost allocation. And that renewable energy is the 15,000 megawatts that Jennifer alluded to a moment ago. The group is organized with an executive committee with a regulator and a governor's representative from each of the five states. It's a fairly executively driven body. We have solicited periodically feedback from stakeholders, but probably not in a way or in frequency or in a way that has been done before. The group split into two work groups, one to study transmission planning or generation zones, and the other to talk about cost allocation. And the zones, the little ovals that were in a previous map, are partly a result of what that body had done. The most important piece of that job, I think, is what we've called regionalization, that is getting the five states into a room and have them start talking about their differences, talking about their economic drivers, their policy issues, and the like, and having a sufficient level of trust to work with one another and drop some of the pretenses.
I have some questions of Jennifer.
Please.
Were there other questions?
Representative Beard.
Okay, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the testifiers, the 15,000 megawatts of new generation that's coming on that you spoke about, from whence comes that number? Is that a legislatively set mandate, or is that what the need's going to be? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that is the legislated renewable goals or standards cumulatively for the five states, the amount that's in excess that's not currently met.
So it would be fair to say then, Madam Chair, that if we're going to hit the 15,000 legislatively mandated megawatts that are going to be required over the next few years, it is possible that that would be replacing some generation, could be shifting areas where generation is happening.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that's certainly possible. And I think I'm not sure we've yet done some of the phasing issues about retiring facilities. That's clearly part of the planning, but it's very preliminary.
Thank you. This is important for us to understand, Madam Chair.
Representative
Beard. Dr. Boyd, I could see where that would necessitate changing the nature of corridors that exist already, maybe create new ones. But when you're looking at, and this is the follow-on question, when you're looking at corridors that are out there right now, the average layperson in the street says, well, there's already a power line from here to there. Why can't we just buckle on to that one? When you're thinking about these things, are you thinking about system redundancy, parallel paths, multiple pathways for security purposes, or what drives those decisions for not using an existing corridor and just upgrading but building one 15 miles away parallel to it, for instance?
Dr. Boyd.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, the answer is yes to all of those things. We're actually tasked to look for existing corridors first, if we can possibly do so.
Okay.
Some cases, existing lines can be reconductored. They can be brought up in scale. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they cannot without swap out of physical structures and the like. There, particularly as the voltage of the lines goes up, it is necessary to have parallel multiple pathways in order to see the system maintain its reliability level. So all of the things you talked about are issues that are in the planning process.
Can I add to
Thank
that?
You.
Madam Chair, can I add to that
Ms. White?
Answer? Because I think that's a very good question. And I agree with what Chair Boyd just said. However, there are limits because the North American Reliability Corporation, NERC, which is the governmental entity that whose primary job is to oversee the grid in the U.S. and parts of Canada to make sure that it's reliable. And they have oversight penalty authority when transmission owners don't do what they're supposed to do. Part of their rules say that although corridors are fine, corridors can't be the only thing that transmission owners depend on, simply because if you have a tornado go through a corridor and all of the transmission lines are in one corridor, you're going to take all those transmission lines out. So although corridors are a very good tool to use, there has to be a redundancy elsewhere that can pick up and continue power flows in the case of tornadoes or ice storms or any of those other kinds of things.
And Ms. White, would you just identify yourself for the record, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair, Mariah White, Office of Energy Security.
Thank you. And Ms. Curran, one of the things is that as we've adopted policy for an increased renewable standard, that we're trying to get our projects up and running as quickly as possible, and it has been a lengthy process. And what we're finding is that some projects are ready that want to get into the queue have to wait in order to hook into transmission. And so I'm wondering what's being done to speed up that process for these renewable projects. If anything can be done. And the other thing is that it's costly. And I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done about decreasing the cost. We've gotten numbers of letters from people who are overwhelmed with the cost of building new transmission lines or being assessed even second assessments because the first one was an overwhelming amount, but then they get assessed again, and they're usually small landowners that are having to pay for this, and And I'm just wondering if that can be accommodated in any way and if that's been taken into consideration for your planning.
Certainly, Madam Chair, from the perspective of the time it takes to interconnect, we have recently, actually in the fall of 2008, implemented new transmission interconnection study procedures that do provide opportunity for that interconnection work to go faster for those that are not in the highly constrained transmission zones. I think a lot of the time that has to be spent when there is a large amount of generation or even a small amount of generation in a location where there is no transmission capacity, the need to design that capacity necessitates a fairly long horizon. It's just a fact of there not being appropriate transmission today. So having said that, there are requests, I believe, including those in the state of Minnesota, that have been able to move faster under this new procedure. Having said that, there are some that still do require this longer timeline because of the geography. That, I think, also gets to your question about cost. The question of geography that Dr. Boyd spoke to earlier is what drives, I think, the high level of transmission cost that we are seeing for some of these generator interconnection projects. New transmission lines are having to be built to allow that generation to deliver its energy to the grid, and the cost of that transmission is fairly high. I do believe we'll be talking a little bit further about some work that's going on to look at the question of cost allocation and who pays for that.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kern, to piggyback on that question, is there a difference between the states and their on this regional outlet zones? The ones that participate, the five states, are there differences in their ability to interconnect onto the queue? Do they have to go through a different process? There's a tremendous amount of development in Iowa that just seemed to have sprung up automatically. So I'm just wondering if it's easier for them to connect onto the MISO queue, or what's happening here?
I think it's fair to say at this point that within the western portion of the Midwest ISO, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, is largely gone. So any recent activity you might have seen could have been taking advantage of those last few open spots. But by and large, the work of the Regional Generation Outlet Study is showing that ability to connect easily, that excess transmission, if you will, in the locations where the wind is looking to site is largely gone.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
So, Ms. Curran, we will be all on the same level playing field after this study is done and after, as far as connecting, and no one state's going to have a different advantage or more of an advantage.
That's
to connection.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. Well, maybe I'd like to ask the question of Dr. Boyd then. Is our regulatory process the best regulatory process for siting and getting these transmission lines up and going, or do other states have some advantages that we don't that allow them to hook in faster than we do?
Madam Chair, the Midwest ISO piece of this is, as was just discussed, not a state-specific piece, and the zones, if I hold off for 1 second, the zones that are under study really haven't done anything in terms of moving to the queue at all yet. So, but now, in terms of our processes are thorough, and I think our processes are fair. And I'm not sure that changing our regulatory site or routing process is going to really significantly increase the rate at which transmission is built. There's a juggling act going on now between the financing, the interconnection queue, the study process that has to be done in advance of putting a line up. And really the nut we all have to crack now is how to handle the cost allocation. So I'm comfortable with the way our processes are right now.
Are you going to address that cost allocation process?
I think Mariah drew the short straw on that one.
Okay. Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To I guess any of the testifiers, there seems to be an implicit assumption here that of the roughly 13,000 remaining megawatts, that the source of that energy is going to be from wind that are in, that wind resources that are in apparently fairly clearly defined areas. Is that an underlying assumption in this planning?
Dr. Boyd?
Madam Chair Hilty, that was an assumption going into this this RGOS study or the UMTDI study, that were the states to meet their renewable objectives exclusively with wind, we tried to prioritize those zones based on the efficiency with which the wind blows and then some good old-fashioned horse trading among the states in order to get the job done. It's a proposal. It is not a binding obligation on any state to fully participate. It's an attempt to try and take a larger vision of the problem from a sub-regional standpoint and offer a solution. But ultimately, it will be up to participants to take advantage of these suggestions. So other zones, other lines will and projects will surely come to the forefront. We may not have selected the very best zones. There's still solar and biomass to be woven into this. But the assumption was that to generate the number of megawatts of wind or of renewables, wind would be the key driver, the predominant source.
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, we didn't ignore other types of renewable generation at all. When we first set this up, the UMTDI set up what we were going to look at as far as for planning indicative purposes. The five states did discuss biomass and solar, PV, different options like that. However, the five states agreed that for the most part, wind generation technology would probably be the predominant generation that would be used for all for the five states' RPSs. So that's why, for just convenience sake or planning sake, wind was used. However, it was discussed and it was considered the other types of renewables, and nothing is meant to preclude other types of renewables.
And Madam Chair, Ms. White or Dr. Boyd, what is the basis for the demand projections that we're operating on?
Dr. Boyd. The demand projections come from utility, someone will correct me, I think these come from utility-based projections of their load in time periods moving forward.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, the number comes from a combined number for the 25% for Minnesota times its load, 10% for Wisconsin times its load, and I believe there's a renewable, not a mandate, but an objective in Iowa times its load. So that minus the wind that's already spinning is how they derive the numbers.
I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood, Representative Hilty. I thought you were asking about the projections for load growth into the future.
Chair, Dr. Boyd, that is, in fact, what I was asking.
You're talking for all load or base load?
Yes. Yes, there seems to be, Madam Chair, an assumption that the additional renewable requirement, I mean, that the renewable requirement is just going to be an addition to an assumption about load growth that, as far as I've ever been able to ascertain, is simply based on a projection from history into the future. We've had 2% load growth for the last 20 years, so we're going to have 2% load growth for the next 20 years.
Representative Hilty.
Is that not the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, that is the case, though there are different growth horizons that are modeled. There are larger growth, midterm growth, low growth forms that are in the projections. And the significance of your question in part is to calculate how many megawatts you believe you need by 2025. If you don't know the total load, then you don't know how many megawatts of renewables will constitute 25% of delivered electricity.
We had asked for that report, and it was due last November. Was then told we would receive it by April, and we haven't received it yet. So it is a report we're looking forward to receiving.
And Madam Chair, I think the significance of this questioning is that there seems to me to be the possibility for enormous reductions in demand just in terms of efficiency in our that we know how to do currently, as well as a lot of possibility for the future. I don't think anyone would have imagined the energy consumption of some of the modern appliances compared to what it was 20 or 30 years ago. It makes me a little uneasy to just have an underlying assumption in all of this that growth is going to continue as it has indefinitely. There are limits to growth.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I agree, but keep in mind that as all models, and people are tired of hearing me berate models, but as all models, they are best guesses into the future. The load growth, the renewable growth, and the transmission will both come online incrementally. There are certainly opportunities to adjust as time goes by. The 1.5% conservation mandate is part of the modeling. Clearly, other parties have asked whether that is too low. And that's part of the reason why there are ranges put into these best guesses. The modelers always cringe when I say that. But as you do these best guesses, there will be need to reevaluate and to assess. But I think we're probably safe incrementally planning on bringing some resources online. Where we end up and the question of phasing and retirement of facilities, those are all important questions that will be addressed, I think, better as time goes by.
Ms. White, were you wanting to comment?
Actually, I think the next slide, where I start talking, is probably going to address some of the questions that you had.
Okay.
This is talking about the legislative studies that you have given both the Office of the Reliability Administrator and the Office of Energy Security to do. The first one is the dispersed renewable generation studies, and these are the only the big studies that you've asked us for. Dispersed renewable generation study was in two phases. The first phase was we were charged to look for locations around the state where we could site 600 megawatts of dispersed generation, smaller projects, with little or no transmission. That report came in, was June 16th of 2008 when we filed that report. We found at that time that the grid around the state was basically constrained, where we could not do such locations except for locations. We did most of the locations in the southeastern part of the state. That was that. Phase two, which you will see next week, was charged with looking at an additional 600 megawatts. But that charge was slightly different in that it was talking about dispersing 600 megawatts around the state and then providing some information on the cost that it would take to upgrade transmission in locations in order to be able to site the 600 megawatts. So that report will be in next week on the 15th. It's going to be a very large report again. And I think it's going to basically show you, since I've reviewed the draft already, it's going to basically show you that the state is just constrained, period, from transmission. And I don't think that many stakeholders will be very surprised to see that. But that report will be coming. The resource assessment study, that's the study that...
What do you mean by constraint? That we don't have the capacity right now?
Or right. There is no, there are no available places, locations around the state where small projects could be sited without having to build upgrades around that area or in other areas to make sure that the grid is not overloaded at some place. That's what I mean by constraint. Sorry.
Okay.
The resource assessment study is the study that has been promised to you. We're doing it in-house. Around all of our docket work that's going on. The generation part is finished. I think it will answer, for example, Representative Hilty's question about if renewable generation, if we have renewable generation to meet the RES, does that replace other generation that we may need in the future? There will be there will be information about that. We will also have information about the forecasting that we did, which looked at a number of measures around the country and sources for trying to figure out what kind of load growth we will have into the future. Again, we did, as Chair Boyd said, we did high scenarios and lower scenarios. That's coming. I'm writing the transmission part. I hope to get that done next week. So hopefully by the end of September, you will be having that report, and it's going to be very large. I can tell you that right now. The RES transmission plan was the plan that Madam Chair mentioned about this is the utilities are tasked with this to provide us with plans for transmission that needs to be done to ensure that the Minnesota's RES will be met at the milestone years that you've set. That report, an update to that report, will be provided with their biennial transmission report on November 1 of 2009.
Yeah, Ms. White, I am interested in that, but really what I was looking at was the baseload needs study that...
Right. That's the resource assessment study.
Oh, it is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, next slide. Now we go to where the rubber meets the road with the cost allocation. Historically, and it's just basic, I think it's just basic accounting that in order to charge a person a cost, you need to try to identify who either causes the cost or who benefits from the cost. And historically, when Chair Boyd talked about how it used to be when utilities took care of customers' needs, it was pretty easy to identify that. With the open market that we have nowadays and the larger footprint and all of the other market forces that are going on, it's much more complicated. There are a number, however, of studies and initiatives that are going on to look into this very question. The first one, the cost allocation and resource planning process, CARP, is the regulators for the 14 states that make up the MISO footprint. The regulators have stepped forward into a leadership role in redoing and relooking at the whole question of cost allocation in the for the MISO footprint. Are meeting very regularly and working very hard for trying to figure out some type of method, some type of way to try to come up with a reasonable, fair, new way to allocate costs among the different parties and different stakeholders in the MISO footprint and beyond the MISO footprint.
What are you considering?
We are considering a number of different what we call cost allocation and rate design methods, looking at trying to identify in this new complicated scenario who benefits from building a power line. Used to be the people right around where the power line was built were the ones that benefited. Well, nowadays, we could build a power line in Minnesota, and people in Indiana could benefit. It's very complex to try to figure that out. It has to do a lot of engineering studies, a lot of transmission power flow studies to try to figure that out. And then when all is said and done, then the states have to look at it and the stakeholders have to look at it and agree with that.
That was my question, and how you can make that fair. I mean, it may bypass Minnesota entirely. It may leave South Dakota and go to Indiana or Illinois.
Absolutely.
And just cross through Minnesota, then how much responsibility does Minnesota have for
exactly
payment of those lines, or even that, how much responsibility do we have to create policy to enable the taking of land for such a transmission line? I mean, we can't think of ourselves in a vacuum because, I mean, we're here to, we may have a resource, much as Texas had oil. We may have a resource that we have to get to another state, but I am very concerned about how the cost is allocated, the impact on our landowners here in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, I couldn't agree more. I think that's one of the fundamental issues that we all are struggling with, me particularly, because my charge, the charge that you've put on me as a state employee is to look out for the customers, the ratepayers. And that includes the landowners. And,
so, Ms. White, are you our representative? I mean, what role does the legislature have to advocate in this process that's a multi-state process? Or is that just left up to MISO to decide? I mean, it seems to me the legislature should have some policies in place that would protect our residents, our state.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. MISO really doesn't decide these things. You have already given us the rules of the road. You have given us the RES that we have to ensure is complied with. You have given us siting rules and regulations. You have given us certificate of need rules and regulations. All of that factors into the charges that we have looking into these regulatory areas. You're right. I am. I and Chair Boyd, actually, and Dr. Haar, right behind us, are representatives on almost all of these planning processes, the transmission planning and cost allocation planning processes. And you have given us our rules of the road in a number of different ways.
I'm not sure, but Representative Beard.
I think I see where you're going, Madam Chair. So let me ask a related question that might. Back on the top of page 20, when you talked about the CARP team, you mentioned something that as a politician I'd love to hear. You folks as regulators stepped forward to show some leadership. Well, that's just great because that means you're out in front. We can throw rocks at you if we don't like what you're doing. I say that with tongue in cheek, of course, because I like most of you. But anyhow, you can figure out which ones. Again, Madam Chair, tongue in cheek. The thought I had, though, is that we're the elected officials around this table hearing this presentation. We hear something like that. My next thought is, well, we appreciate you showing leadership because obviously you're immersed in this, you understand it, and we have other lives that we live. But at some point, you're coming back here with recommendations that we will be discussing, dissecting, and voting on, I believe. You're just not going to implement this and come and tell us what you're doing. That's a soft pitch. You can swing at it if you'd like.
Ms. White?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I doubt that I have the authority to make final decisions on any of this. I represent the state on this process and trying to negotiate with the other states and make and inform them about Minnesota's resources, challenges, and all aspects, our RES, the rules of the road that you've given us. But I don't consider that I have the authority to make final decisions.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Beard.
I think rather than have 14 state legislative bodies get together and try to hash this out, it's probably efficient and probably a more productive use of our time that you do that. We trust that you're looking out for our interest. I think we'll reserve the right to ask you hard questions when you bring this back here, but this is a serious issue. Now, when we're starting to look at wind resources in the Dakotas being sold east of us, nobody wants a power line coming through their bean field or even behind their swing set. So these are going to be important things for us to solve. It's nice to know that they recognize they work for us and they will be bringing us these things for policy consideration.
But I have a question about how that happens, because I'm not aware that we would be voting on anything. And so if you decide that Minnesota is going to pay 20% or where these lines are going to go, then who signs off on that? Do the utility companies, or
no.
Do we trust you, or what happens?
Actually, Madam Chair, this actually is a decision of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The actual request for a cost allocation and rate design is actually a federally regulated question. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen is at the end of these processes, say that they're successful, and we hope that they are, and the states come to a meeting of the minds on a reasonable cost allocation.
Madam Chair, when she says states come to a reasonable...
Representative Beard.
Thank you. I just wanted to be clear, because she's saying something very important. Ms. White, when you say the states come to a meeting of the minds, are you talking about you guys, not us, correct? Well, you as regulators come to a meeting of the minds.
Yeah. Madam Chair, maybe I'll take a swing at this.
Dr. Boyd.
With some trepidation. The negotiators are states through their utility regulators, through their offices of energy security. That's the we that's doing the negotiating. If there is a layer where this body wants to review that decision, I'm sure that could be accommodated, but I guess I would remind everyone that this has happened at least once before I arrived on the scene. The current tariffs were negotiated in much the same way. So whether we knew about it or not, this was happening before.
I apologize for interrupting. The pronouns are flying around. I wanted us all to be sure of who we was. So.
Well, I still have a question about that, but I have to think about my question just a minute. So are you advisory to FERC?
If the CARP group comes to an agreement, that would be regulators leading this understanding. The proposal would go to all of the stakeholders that are part of the Midwest ISO market, the generators, the transmission owners, and they would have an opportunity to endorse this or not endorse this. Assuming it passed through that internal or that Midwest ISO process, the Midwest ISO would petition the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for permission to implement this tariff.
But it doesn't come to any elected body. And
not
so
what
let's say Minnesota says, we don't like this plan, but the other four states say, this is great, we love it, and so mm-hmm. we're going to pass it, I mean, this is the way it's going to be. What do we have other than maybe to deny a certificate of need or something?
Madam Chair, our options would be to try and sway opinion during the conversation and then possibly to intervene with FERC in opposition to the tariff filing. But it's entirely possible that those efforts would be unsuccessful and the majority would rule in creating a tariff structure.
What right do elected bodies have? Any?
I think the legislature could intervene at FERC, just as a utility commission could. I'm looking to other people. I'm not sure about standing, but it's a process that is, as I understand it, historically separated from state legislatures. I may be wrong. And I'm looking
Ms. White.
Behind me.
Madam Chair, I think this is that's the beauty of presentations like this. That we're happy to come and talk to you and tell you what we're doing, and we'd be happy to come back as we go through this process and brief you on what we're doing. So you know what we're doing and know where we're coming from on as we go through the process and different directions are taken. And we can make you aware of challenges. We can make you aware of what other states are thinking, areas of agreement, areas of disagreement. So, you know, filings to FERC don't take you by surprise.
Are there minutes from these meetings that you could transmit to us so that we could?
Yes.
Certainly, yes. I think so. If you'd like them, certainly.
It's a little bit like reading the phone book.
Oh, that's what I figured. Might be better to have you come and report to us from time to time, huh? Now, we've interrupted many times. Would you like
to? No, but Madam Chair, I think the point is not that there's anything going on. I don't think there are any participants who are who knowingly or consciously are hiding the ball here. Maybe the question hasn't been posed before about the extent to which you would be interested in following this, participating, and expressing your thoughts through us.
I think we're all busy, and we all.
I understand that.
And we all have lots of things to pay attention to. But by the same token, I think especially some legislators have a higher interest than others because of the people in their districts that are affected by many of your decisions. And so, it's better to have foresight than in hindsight. And we'd certainly rather be informed ahead of time than after the fact. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I got an understanding I need clarified. In the MISO grid, there's 14 states, one Canadian province. Is that correct?
I believe it's 13 states and one province. But
13 and one.
Close enough.
Well, Madam Chair, my solution would be let's just have the Canadians pay for it. Got them all numbered.
I'll vote for that.
Sharing the wealth, Madam Chair.
As we can adopt their health.
Representative Magnus, you might be shocked to learn that proposal's come up before.
Okay. Trying to help.
Representative Hornstein says as long as we can adopt their health plan.
Adopt their health plan.
We do have to move along. I'm sorry, but we do have to move along.
Certainly. Let's see. We talked about CARP. The RECB, Regional Expansion Cost and Benefits, this is basically the same type of planning process as the regulators are going through with CARP. This includes all of the stakeholders. So we're talking about marketers. We're talking about utilities. We're talking about independent transmission owners, generators, large and small and medium, and any number of different stakeholders. So that is going on parallel with the CARP process. Lastly, the Upper Midwest Transmission Development Initiatives that Chair Boyd talked about earlier for the planning part has a cost allocation part that is going on right now. And I'll go on to the next one. This looks very complicated, and it's even more complicated than it looks. The question comes many times that, well, we've got all these processes going all over the place. We've got all these planning processes. We've got all these cost allocation processes. Do they actually touch each other, or are they all going off in different directions? Very valid question. All of these processes do feed into or inform all of these other processes. Actually, Jennifer Curran was the one who put this together, but I think this is a very illustrative slide because all of the processes that we're talking about today do intersect and inform and move into each other, such that we are always very mindful of all the other processes out there so we don't mess things up. Now, we have two specific local situations that I'm sure that you have heard about because they're local and they're actually unique in the country right now, where we have projects or utilities that are caught in the middle between the rules of the road, the cost allocation rules of the road, which are still based on the old situation where the utility takes care of the customer's needs and that's it, versus the way where the world is now with all of the different public policy impacts, the conservation impacts, the demand side management impacts, all of the other impacts that were shown on the slide with the puzzle pieces. And so basically we'll just touch on those two situations, and then I think you're going to hear more about them from other presenters. The first one is called basically the otter tail situation. What's going on with this is that the otter tail service area, as you'll see from the first set of bullets, is that, let me get to the right one, here we go. The otter tail situation has a transmission capacity in their service territory of about 1,000 megawatts. Right now they have interconnection requests for 8,500 megawatts that want to move on that 1,000 megawatts of transmission. Almost most of these, I would say, is wind projects. We still are under the until the CARP and RECB and UMTDI situations come up with new tariff proposals to apply to FERC for approval, we still have to operate under the old cost allocation rules. The old cost allocation rules that say that because the utility watched out for customers, so the utility was the one who interconnected the generators, so therefore the local utility, as the generator owner, is supposed to pay for the interconnections, which means that Otter Tail would be, according to the old rules, have to pay for the interconnections. What we're talking about here is a significant adverse impact to Otter Tail and its customers. If you look at the third bullet, if we only look at interconnecting approximately 20% of that 8,500 megawatts, Otter Tail's customers will look at a 44% cost impact or a rate increase, just to be able to fund the interconnections for those wind projects that are requesting them, even though the vast majority of the wind projects are not going to provide power to Otter Tail's customers.
So how can that be? I mean, how do you justify that?
Well, we don't. it's a very tough situation because this is an Otter Tail and the wind developers in Otter Tail's territory are caught between the old rules and what we're looking at now. So what happened was it went a stakeholder process, a RECB process happened. A proposal was put forth to make the generators pay the majority of the costs for these interconnections rather than Otter Tail in order to mitigate the impact on Otter Tail's customers. This proposal was filed with FERC as just a stopgap, a Band-Aid, until the new rules could be fleshed out with CARP and RECB and UMTDI, and new proposals could be filed with FERC to help Otter Tail and its customers. That was filed. The wind developers are very strongly against this. They are fighting this very much. Right now, it's at FERC. FERC has just issued a request for more information. That happened about a week and a half ago. And so that's where it stands right now.
So this is a preliminary allocation that will be revised? Or?
We're hoping what will happen is that this will take care of this situation and situations that are very similar to it only until the new cost allocation can come into FERC and be approved by FERC. So hopefully, maybe a year, that it would be maintained until it's just a stopgap until the new rules could be put into place.
So do you anticipate those Otter Tail customers will be made whole then? No?
Madam Chair, if I may, the request that we made was to have this effective as of the middle of this past July, so that any interconnection request that was signed and that associated transmission would the cost would be assigned under these rules that we have proposed. So any interconnection request signed in the coming year would have the generator rather than the load pay. and the request for the immediate...
The generator rather than the...
The load, the Otter Tail load in this case. So the request for immediate relief was to get that in place before the Otter Tail customers would actually see these costs.
Okay. Representative Beard.
Well, Madam Chair, just an observation. Maybe it's a question just to verify my assumption of Dr. Boyd or whoever. 8,500 megawatts of wind is seeking to be located there, not because any particular load center is calling for it or because anybody came and filed a certificate of need and proved their case. 8,500 megawatts of wind is there because legislators said so. There's a mandate, correct? And that's the only reason this situation is existing.
Madam Chair, Representative
Beard, Dr. Boyd.
That and the quality of the wind resource in that particular part of the country.
Just an observation, Madam Chair, that this is not the market driving this. This is people sitting around this table that made this up, put these folks in this predicament.
Ms. White. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair. Ms. White, how far along is this 8,500 megawatts? I'm sure they're at varying stages of their application or their financing, but can you give me an idea? Are these ready to go? Have they placed their order?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, you are correct. I think these projects are in any amount of stage. Mm-hmm. Some of them are just starting. Some of them are probably at the ending stage. That is actually a question that the FERC staff asked MISO to answer and give them specifics about every one of the projects that would be impacted. That's the letter that they sent to MISO a week and a half ago asking for that information.
Okay, you can continue.
The next slide has to do with the other situation that is caught between the old rules and the world nowadays, and this is the project that you have probably heard about maybe the most. We call it the Brookings situation. What is going on with this is that the Brookings line from Brookings, South Dakota, to basically the Twin Cities, edge of the Twin Cities line was proposed as part of the three-line CapEx group. The line basically, if you'll see from the first bullet group, those are the reasons for the line. And basically, you will see stabilizing the region, increasing, you know, reliability in the region, and provide outlet for the entire wind area. Now, you notice that we're talking about region, and entire wind area, which is basically all three of those are more than Minnesota. However, this is where we're caught, because the old rules that FERC still has to operate by, FERC is, MISO is a federally regulated entity that has to operate by its FERC-approved tariff. It can't just change it by itself. It has to go through a process and apply to FERC for it. According to the old rules, the old MISO rules, even though there's regional benefit for this line, and almost nobody argues that there is reasonable benefit to this line, the way the tariffs are made in the old rules, it says that this is a local use line. Which means that the generators who hook to this line basically should pay for this line. That's a very, we're talking $700 million for a transmission line. It's a huge amount of money. The next bullet group that you'll see, there's approximately, I believe Beth is sitting behind me, I think it's 23 projects. That are dependent on the Brookings line being constructed for their projects. Oh, 19. Beth says 19. Thank you, Beth. These projects are located not only in Minnesota but in South Dakota and Iowa. They all, however, need the Brookings line as an outlet for their wind, to provide their wind to the market, to be able to sell their wind into the market and or sell it to specific customers. The wind generators, as you can very easily guess, are very, very concerned about this and very much objecting to having to pay this huge amount of money. However, we're having the CapEx partners are also looking at it and saying that because PPAs would, our purchase power agreements would be the ultimate decider, contracts between the wind energy generator and the ultimate utility, and PPAs have not been signed yet. But this wind is not meant exclusively for the CapEx customers. So there may be CapEx customers, if CapEx partners are having to pay for this line, CapEx customers may not get benefit of this line commensurate with the amount of money that they would have to pay. We've been holding several meetings, full-day meetings, with the generators, with the CapEx partners. MISO has been there. We've been there discussing every inch of this situation to try to come up with some kind of path that could work for all of the parties. I think everybody is committed to continue to talk about this. I've seen good commitment among the wind generators to be talking about this. Beth Soholton, Wind on the Wires, has played a very strong leadership role with this. Midwest ISO has conducted these meetings and provided all of the transmission background information that it can. These meetings are not finished. I can't guarantee you that we're going to come up with something, but we are talking.
You said you can't guarantee?
Unfortunately, I can't guarantee.
It will be highly unfair if you can't come up with something.
We're going to have to come up with something.
Okay. Madam Chair, the last few slides are self-explanatory. They're just a summary of things that you've heard us say about how things were, how things are now, and the efforts that are underway to try and find a way to bridge that gap. So in the interest of time, we'll just skip those.
I appreciate that, and I realize that our questions have probably taken you off track a few times, too. But I think it has been an informative discussion, and you've really laid the groundwork in the background for the future presentations here. I appreciate it. There's a lot. I don't envy you in some of the negotiations you're in and the work that you're undertaking, but I appreciate your efforts there.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask the next four presenters to please limit your comments to about 10 minutes if possible. So 10 minutes each. First one is Beth Soho.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Beth Soholt with Wind on the Wires, and with me today I have Paul White from Project Resources Corporation. We are actually going to do a joint presentation, so you'll either have lots of time for questions or gain a little bit on your agenda.
Okay, thank you.
We are here to talk about the Brookings line, which was mentioned in the previous presentation. As was mentioned also, there are a lot of complicated facts about this transmission line and about the cost allocation issues, but we have been working very hard to try to work with the Midwest ISO, the CapEx utilities, and other stakeholders to try to figure this out. And we'll try to set the context for you quickly to understand, get you up to date on what's been happening. So on May 22nd, the Public Utilities Commission did grant certificates of need for the three CapEx transmission lines, and one of them was the Brookings project. as you know, it's a long, couple hundred mile, 345 kV transmission line running from Brookings, South Dakota, to the Hampton Corner substation in the southeast quadrant of the Twin Cities area. As MISO goes through classifying transmission, they have to live within the four corners of the tariff that is approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So they have buckets of things that they have to look at in classifying transmission lines. For the Brookings line, they've run it through their different screens to classify the transmission line, and it does not qualify as a baseline reliability project that would be much more highly cost-shared. And so they've classified it as other, with it primarily being providing capacity, generator outlet capacity, and hence that gets us the large allocation to the generators. And so in classifying this approximately $700 million line, MISO has identified the Group 5. MISO classifies interconnection customers into groups to study what is needed from a technical perspective to enable those different types of projects to interconnect. Group 5 has 19 projects, about a dozen different developers. They're all wind projects that are looking to interconnect. And I think, Senator Rosen, you asked for in the Otter Tail situation, you know, how are the projects situated? We have projects that are ready to ink their financing, but for the cost allocation on the Brookings line. We have people who have wind turbines stored waiting to go up on their projects. Almost all 19 projects have bid into multiple requests for proposal from utilities, but they can't finish their power purchase negotiations until they know for their project what their cost responsibility is going to be or not for their portion of the Brookings transmission line. So we're caught between, I think, as Mariah used the term, between the old and the new world. We don't have a different kind of cost allocation mechanism that recognizes all the benefits that the Brookings transmission line is providing the region, not just Minnesota, but it's regionally beneficial for other states as well. So we have to live within what the tariff currently, what the MISO tariff currently has developed for cost allocation. Now, the conversations that have been going on have largely been centered around a one-time variance on the cost allocation for the Brookings line that would be negotiated among the parties and would be filed with FERC for approval. So recognizing that we're caught between these two worlds, something worked out that enables the line to go forward. I know CapEx is very committed to building the line, something that that is equitable for the generators, given the 11th-and-a-half-hour notification that they were going to be responsible for a significant amount of the transmission upgrade, something that is equitable for all parties. That's not an easy solution to come to. But some of the other factors that go into this situation are that projects really were not aware until mid-May that they were going to be responsible for the cost of this transmission line or that each project would bear a significant amount of transmission upgrade on their projects. Projects that are in the late stages of development have zero capacity to go back to their equity provider and say, I now have to come up with $15 million more. You know, there's just no capacity in the financing when they're at a very, very late stage of development. And so I want Paul to address specifically for his project. I thought it would be helpful to hear from a developer who is in, you know, a pretty advanced stage of development. And so we'll flip to his slide and on slide 6 and let Paul describe his project.
Thank you. I'm Paul White, president of Project Resources Corporation. I guess this Our project is a Minnesota seabed project down in Pipestone County. And I just have three slides that summarize this project. I think it's a pretty good example of how the Brookings line kind of came out of the thin air and hit us. One thing I would like to add to Beth's comments is just that I think that we all saw the Brookings line as being thought of as assumed to be a backbone in many other projects, not just Group 5, but also Group 4. I think it goes back into prior groups that was sort of in the mix, so it was very surprising that it sort of popped up at the last minute. So describing this as a 20-megawatt project, G621 is the reference number that MISO uses to keep track of it. The interconnection request was originally made in 2006, to request in-service date of 2007. The interconnect studies and whatnot took a long time for this and other projects in Group 5, and hence, by default, kind of slid to 2009 target for in-service date. The end of last year, things were looking very good for 2009 in-service. We're wrapping up the facility study, which is the last step MISO goes through before we sign the interconnect agreement. And as we got into the winter, we got a little bit nervous about 2009. We wanted to get the project done in 2009. And so on the second slide, you can see we have all of our project work done. In order to ensure that we could meet a 2009 in-service date, you see that we signed an E&P agreement. So we effectively paid $100,000 of advance money to fund engineering work for the interconnection to the Chanarambie substation. You sort of do that when you're pretty sure you're done and all signs are go, but it's just a matter of paperwork to get the interconnect agreement signed and inked so you can proceed with financing. So it's our risk, but we were fairly comfortable. It's a three-way agreement between MISO, Xcel Energy, and the project. As you see, again, on the second slide, everything is done in the project, for land leases to negotiating with BOP contractors, except the interconnect still was hanging out undone. And lo and behold, I think it was May, thereabouts this year, that the Brookings issue kind of reared its head. And the last slide on page 8, I think, of this presentation kind of summarizes what that does to the project in terms of economics. Initially, the two blue bullets, they're not blue, but the first two bullets show sort of the base case for the project was a $1.2 million interconnect cost. And that's based on roughly a $40 to $45 million project cost to build the entire project. You'd have between $1 and $2 million interconnection cost. That's reasonable and affordable for a project to handle. Worst case, even without Brookings, we were in this Group 5 group study, and that means there's some contingency between the projects in that group that if one drops out, maybe the rest have to share some of those upgrades pro rata, the cost of the upgrade. So we were warned by MISO that if everybody else in Group 5 dropped out, we probably would see something in the range of $12 million of additional cost for our interconnect. Through engineering work and careful study of Group 5 and watching those projects move forward, we can mitigate and get comfortable that is an unlikely risk that we would have that additional $12 million of cost. So that's sort of a green light go scenario that we could finance under. Then in May, we have the second two bullets, and it shows what happened. Basically, the $720 million of extra cost. The spreadsheet came out from MISO that showed 1.62% of that would be allocated to our project. That equates to $11.4 million of additional costs. So we'd have our $1.2 million plus at least $11.4 million. So we're looking at around $12 million for sure under the Brookings generator pay-for-it scenario, if you will. And that is devastating to the economics of a project. It takes the dollars per megawatt of interconnect costs from $60 a megawatt up to $630 a megawatt. Worst case, and the kicker is that not only are we guaranteed to have to pay $12.6 million, but MISO is not guaranteeing that we won't have to pay our project the entire $720 million. And it's pretty amazing. But, hypothetically, MISO, if everybody dropped out except us and we're the ones sitting holding the bag and there's a $720 million power line that has to be paid for, under that formula, the guys that are left standing are carrying the bag. So,
well, if it is cost prohibitive, it's quite possible that most of the projects could drop out, right?
And it, essentially, that is the reality of where we're at: is that all the projects realize that this is a non-starter, and if it was to go forward, all the projects would very likely drop out, and then the next group of projects would face the same thing, and they would have to drop out. So it's really kind of just knocking down, generator interconnections and making them impossible to proceed. The way that I look at it, sort of from a policy, if I put policy hat on, I think of a gaggle of wind developers, everything from a international utility company that's developing projects in Minnesota to a mom and pop shop farmer group trying to do a project. They're not coordinated in any way. They don't have any coordination to finance a public infrastructure project like a $700 million 50 to 60 year lifespan power line. It just doesn't fit and it'll never happen. So we did go through some soul searching in the discussions that have gone on with MISO that MISO has hosted. And, we thought about that hard and tried to figure out how we could work this. And can we get together and coordinate and do something? But it just, in the end, it just seems very impractical and something else has got to happen.
So, Madam Chair, I don't want to leave on such a depressing note. So there are, of the 19 projects in Group 5, there are a significant number of seabed projects that are smaller projects that have quite significant, like Paul has, chunks of millions assigned to their project. But for figuring out the cost allocation on the Brookings line, they would be moving their projects forward. I know the state has an interest in seeing those projects come to fruition. Group 5 is not only seabed, but there's a fair number of projects in Group 5 that are seabed projects. And so I think that we are really at a point where the cost allocation discussions from a governor level and a state regulator level on a regional basis really have to come to fruition with some new cost allocation methodology and cost recovery for the utilities. And it has to realize that the generators, while they may be triggering the need for new transmission line capacity, are not the only beneficiaries. There are reliability benefits. There are local load serving benefits. There are congestion reduction costs that come from new transmission lines. And having the generators be the ones that fund the transmission lines is not the right way to go about building large transmission infrastructure. And so we are continuing on a day-in and day-out basis to try to participate in the cost allocation discussions and help the stakeholder group come to some kind of determination about what a reasonable cost allocation is.
It's pretty grim. Questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Soholt, you said Group 5. How many megawatts was that total?
1,300. It's like 1,294, 1,300 megawatts in Group 5.
Okay, and are they all about the 20-megawatt range?
They range in size from about 18 megawatts to a couple hundred.
Thank you.
Were you going to go through the last two slides? I have a question about your summary.
Sure.
I was just thinking, that second bullet, does everybody agree with that? or only Group 5?
Well, great question, Madam Chair. I think that the MISO, the Midwest ISO stakeholder process have certainly recognized that there are multiple benefits from transmission lines. But certainly it gets more controversial when you try to parse out, cost causers and beneficiaries. The MISO tariff needs to be developed a little bit more to put a dollar figure on some of those benefits. What does reliability, what are people willing to pay for reliability? What does reliable local load serving cost, and what does it benefit? If we're able to move power longer distances and you see benefits to retail customers as a result, what is that worth? And then, being able to enable the type of generation that public policy is demanding, clean energy, there's a benefit to that. So it is a complicated formula, but just having generators pay is not the right policy.
So I'm not going to call MISO back at this time, but did they agree with you?
Boy, I'm not sure I can speak for them,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Maybe I'll call them back at the end.
Okay.
Representative Knuthen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm trying to understand, because to me it seems untenable that the Group 5 projects could pay for this transmission line and actually have it work. And I don't want to see all the Group 5 projects basically pull out, but that seems like what could happen. And just worst-case scenario, if that were to happen, then who pays for the Brookings line at that point? If we don't figure out a solution to this and MISO doesn't, all the stakeholders, what happens then? Who would pay for it?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, I believe MISO has the ability to do what they call backfill. So they take a project that's in the interconnection queue in that area that needs transmission capacity, and they basically slot it in for somebody that's dropped out of the queue. But with the dollar amounts that we're talking about, it's going to be unlikely that they're going to be able to find projects that are able to withstand these kinds of dollars added to their project. Even if they're in the early stages of development and can factor in additional transmission costs, they're going to say, boy, this project needs, $100 million worth of upgrades, but maybe a project in another state that is promoting renewable energy as well has $10 million worth of upgrades. I'm going to put my dollars into another state. And so until we get over this dilemma of needing to build some additional transmission infrastructure, projects are going to be similarly impacted, and it's going to be difficult for them to develop their projects.
Well, also, why wouldn't projects delay until it was up and running? And then they can basically be free riders, right?
I think, Madam Chair, MISO is looking really closely at free rider policy, and, that's being addressed in some of the stakeholder discussions on cost allocation. What is going to happen with these projects, I'll just talk about Group 5, is in order to be able to continue moving through the queue and keep their place in the MISO queue, they're going to have to do what a couple of projects have done, and that's file unexecuted generator interconnection agreements with FERC, disputing having to pay for the large amount of transmission upgrades. And so it will be adjudicated by FERC, or we don't know exactly what FERC will do. They may decide that all of these are adding up to something that they need to address, and they may do it, or they may say, somebody else needs to figure this out. So,
okay. Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, I think this might be my question was, obviously, if there are no viable projects, the line wouldn't need to be built in the first place. My question is, what is the current interconnection capacity and existing transmission totally maxed out, or is there additional capacity for some projects if the Brookings line is not built?
Madam Chair and Representative Hilty, I'm not a transmission engineer, but working in this as much as I do, these projects will not go forward without the Brookings line. And in that geographic location, these projects have no option except for you know, the communities that are looking to host these projects are going to be disappointed because these projects will have no option for interconnecting. They will just shovel-ready projects will not be able to go forward.
Thank you.
Anything further? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next presenter is Laura McCartan and also Terry Grove. But while they're coming to the table, could I have a motion to approve the minutes of August 4th?
So moved.
Any discussion? All those in favor then of approving the Tuesday, August 4th Legislative Energy Commission minutes, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Welcome.
Thank you. They were up there.
Madam Chair, Pretner Solon, Chair Hilty, members of the commission, we very much appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. In the yellow
cap, I ask you to pull your microphone a little closer so that we can hear you a little better.
In the yellow CapEx folder given to members of the commission, our presentation is in printed form.
And also, if you just identify yourself for the record.
I'm Terry Grove, and with me is Laura McCartan, and we are co-executive directors of the CapEx 2020 initiative. In the yellow packet is our presentation in printed form. Apologies to those in the audience. We will post it at our website and can make it available electronically to the committee. Skipping to slide three, we realize you're trying to keep these short. Just a little background on the CapEx utilities that will help explain our position on these issues. It's a large initiative. It includes 11 municipal, cooperative, and investor-owned utilities that serve most of the load in Minnesota and a good deal of load in surrounding states and own a tremendous amount of transmission, 42,000 miles. Of those utilities, many are nationally recognized leaders in renewable energy and wind. For instance, Xcel Energy has over 4,000 megawatts of wind. Minn Kota Power Cooperative and Great River Energy were recognized as the number one and number two suppliers of wind power energy, and Southern Municipal Power Agency was recognized as the number five supplier of wind energy nationally. So as the utilities, we have bought wind and we continue to, and we've had to learn how to develop transmission.
Would you go over those five again once more, please?
Sure. Xcel Energy is over 4,000 megawatts of wind.
Can I just add, we're also the nation's number one wind provider. We always like to get that in there, too.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great Some River Energy Denver. And Minn Kota Power Cooperative were the number one and two cooperative wind energy suppliers in 2008. And Southern Municipal Power Agency was the number five municipal wind power supplier nationally.
Okay.
And we, as a result, we've had to work our way through transmission development and the complex policy issues that were described to you. Of the 11 CapEx project participant utilities, certain utilities will own each of the projects we have under development. If you flip to the Group 1 project slide, that's a summary of the four projects under development now. There's been quite a bit of discussion of the Brookings project, but that's only one of four projects that are being developed together and work as an integrated system. It's a huge undertaking, nearly 700 miles of transmission, a cost of between $1.6 and $1.9 billion. This scale ranges from Fargo, North Dakota, to Brookings, South Dakota, to the La Crosse, Wisconsin area. None of these projects were planned with a single need in mind, as Beth described. They were planned as an integrated system. This started a long time ago. In 2004, the initial ideas were kicked around. As Chair Boyd and Mariah White described, at that time, the regional planning processes were not as evolved as they are today. So the CapEx utilities begin planning these and then in turn incorporated them into the Midwest ISO planning processes as those came into their own. The primary purpose overall of all four projects is to serve load reliably in Minnesota and the surrounding area. We've had decades of load growth. Communities such as Rochester and St. Cloud and Alexandria has grown hugely. Going to Chair Hilty's comments, load growth may change in the future, and that was analyzed in the planning studies. It will still continue at some rate, albeit probably slower. Besides load growth, these were also planned to create a very flexible foundation for future project development for things, as Chair Boyd described, if Minnesota becomes an exporter of renewable energy to surrounding states, if other types of resources are developed, it's a plan where the state can, of Minnesota and other states, can set their policy objectives, and these are projects that we think are used and useful no matter how policy evolves. And finally, as others have spoken to, it's a big initial step in these large projects towards providing renewable or capability for wind on the Buffalo Ridge of Minnesota and in far eastern South Dakota. Turning to your slide, mark progress on the Group 1 projects. Once we got through the planning process, it's taken a tremendous amount of effort by all stakeholders to move these forward. I particularly want to salute the Minnesota Office of Energy Security and Minnesota PUC. They've had to put forth an immense effort of moving these through the process on the regulatory timeline that was agreed to. Other stakeholders, you've heard from several of them already today, have had to also participate, and it's made demands on everybody, but they have moved through the process very well. Minnesota PUC, as you heard, granted a certificate of need, single certificate of need for the three 345 projects and a separate certificate of need for the Bemidji project in northern Minnesota. We're now at the stage with Minnesota's bifurcated process, need first, routing second, of filing route permits. A route permit has been filed for the Brookings project, the Bemidji project, and for the first segment of the Fargo project. We expect the remaining two route permits to be filed later in 2009. Those route permits are moving through the process, and I'll be discussed more in a moment. And we're also now in discussions and have been some time with neighboring states, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, and federal agencies on integrating the Minnesota permitting process with their permitting process. Those are also going very well. The other states were, by design, going to trail the Minnesota permitting process a bit, and those are starting now. So that'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Terry. Madam Chair and committee members, I'd like to talk a little bit now about the details of the routing processes that we're going through for all of these projects, and then also our public outreach and communication efforts, and then finally a couple of remarks about the Brookings cost allocation issue, which we are very deeply involved in. On slide 6, which is titled Overview of Minnesota Route Review, let me just start there and speak a little bit about the process, which is the authority for granting or designating an approved route lies with the Minnesota Public Utility Commission. And it is a, as you can imagine, as I'm sure you've heard from your constituents and which we have also heard as we've been out meeting with the public, it's something that impacts people directly, and you need to make sure you do it right. People need to have due process, and we've approached it very seriously with that in mind. So with that in mind, for each of the four projects, somewhere between a year and 2 years worth of work took place in the field with environmental review, environmental consultants and professionals, several meetings with members of the public to provide a lot of opportunity for input so that as we looked at all the possible route options for every project, we could assure ourselves that we were getting all the information that was out there from a technical standpoint, environmental information, different routing uses, planned land uses in the future, and a lot of this came from members of the public that attended the meetings that we held and told us what they knew. So it was a great opportunity to exchange information. We did that so that when the time came that we put together a route permit application and submitted that to the PUC, which would start the official route process, that the application we submitted was the best we could make it, the most informed, the most thorough, and something that had the most input from public members of the public and potentially impacted public. We that started then the official route process with the Minnesota Public Utility Commission. And that is also, I'd like to mention, there are two major stages to state review in Minnesota, the need and then the routing. But again, in the interest of time, we started the routing processes sort of overlapping with the Minnesota need process so that we could sort of get a jump on that. The Minnesota route process then is designed to be a place where all of the information that can should come into play in choosing routes comes together. Environmental use or environmental impacts, other land use issues, stakeholder input, members of the public, potentially affected landowners, local government units, where all of this can come together and be assessed. And what the Public Utility Commission has to do then is to try to come up with, because they are the official decider, to come up with a route option that is the best balance of all of those considerations and impacts, because there's no route that is impact-free. The as the Minnesota statutes, Chapter 216E and Rules Chapter 7849, segments of those are what define how the routing process should proceed. Stakeholder input to the routing process is absolutely critical. And this is, again, so all the impacts can be understood and the best balance and choice can be made when the PUC designates a route. That includes members of the public, landowners, and local government units, state agencies such as the OES, which does the environmental review, MnDOT, Department of Agriculture, DNR, and also federal agencies. A lot of the potential routes can impact with river crossings or designated wildlife areas, so we need the involvement of entities such as the Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Forest Service, and they've all of these agencies that I've mentioned have been at the table and working on these processes throughout the effort. An important thing also is that once we submitted our permit application, we did a year to 2 years worth of work. We submitted then a permit application that had to designate at least two route options. Then the official process starts, and from that point, the public also has the opportunity to add and request that certain route segments be added for consideration. As an example, for the Brookings project, the Office of Energy Security is conducting the environmental impact statement, and they have added in 47 route segments for consideration. So it's not end-to-end between Brookings, South Dakota, and the Twin Cities, but the route is actually broken up into many, many small segments between, you know, sub-points all the way through. And 47 additional route segments have been added for review. At the end of the day here, when we look at these four projects, which are close to 700 miles, we estimate that something on the order of 5,000 landowners will be impacted. When we started this process, we didn't know exactly where a specific designated route would land. We had very broad study corridors that we looked at. To ensure that the public had every opportunity from day one to participate, we engaged with something on the order of 73,000 landowners along those 700 miles of the projects to say, this is happening, here's what's going on, here's your opportunity to engage in the process. So ultimately, about 5,000 will be affected, but as we've been going forward, we've been contacting and interacting with over 73,000 landowners in the state. The next slide, page 7, is just to give you a flavor of the magnitude of the outreach and communication that we've undertaken with these projects. We are committed to public participation. It's part of the due process that we think the public is owed, and we're very committed to it. Between 2007 and 2009, close to 500,000 direct mailings have been made for these four projects, going right to potential potentially affected landowners' homes. And we pledge to continue that level of communication. Over that same period, we've held over 300 public meetings, and this ranges from anything such as open houses to presentations to county boards to even meeting with smaller groups of citizens on a very focused, say, routing issue. We've also placed over 300 newspaper ads. So a lot of this started with a certificate of need process. It's continuing through the routing process, and it is, I think, one of the benchmarks that CapEx has set for itself to encourage and promote and enable public participation. Next, I'd like to just speak briefly about the Brookings project, the cost allocation and recovery issue. You've heard a lot about that. Page 8, you've heard how important the Brookings project is to our region and as part of the network of our transmission. It accesses wind-rich areas. It also boosts the performance of future lines. It makes future transmission that much more effective in being able to transfer new generation capacity. And it's also part of maintaining system reliability as customer need grows. The issue with cost allocation is very difficult. We're very engaged as CapEx Utilities and working with the stakeholders to try to find a solution. We as utilities do not have the unilateral authority to say we're going to do this or we're going to do that, because ultimately, $700 million project somehow gets paid for. The question is, which customers pay for it? Does it land with utilities who then put it into the cost of their service, and then their customers pay for it? How much of it should go there? How much of it should be with a wind project so that whoever buys that wind, in the price of the wind, they're also paying for the transmission needed to enable the wind? What's the fair breakdown? It's not apparent, and I think maybe you appreciate that from everything you've heard here. The utilities don't have the unilateral authority to decide something. It's got to be something that our state regulators agree on for those of us whose rates are subject to regulatory proceedings. It has to be consistent with FERC. So it is a difficult issue, but I think that there is a lot of good thinking and a lot of commitment to the fact that the current situation is untenable, and we have to come up with a solution that allows the project to get built and that can go forward and that can be supported by not only those of us here in Minnesota, but also Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota, because this project has impact in all of those states. One thing I will point out is that the development of the Brookings project has been proceeding on pace without delay. All of the certificate of need, all of the routing processes are going forward, and we're looking for those to be complete sometime in 2010. And if we get the cost allocation and recovery issue resolved in 2010, we can move ahead to major construction of that project. And we're certainly looking forward to that, and that is the direction that we are hoping for. So I think that concludes our prepared remarks here. Just wanted to reiterate that the CapEx Utilities came together to propose one of the largest transmission development projects in the nation. It serves our customers' needs, and it enables regional energy policies. The projects are on track, and that's due to a lot of hard effort on everybody's part. And we are committed to working together with the other stakeholders to find a solution for the Brookings cost allocation and recovery issue.
Okay, thank you. There are a few questions. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm curious, I mean, we're talking about who pays for the Brookings line and the cost allocation, the new versus old, and I'm just looking at the map and looking where Big Stone 2 is supposed to be and how that relates to this, and if it's going to be using this line and if they would be paying it and who's going to be benefiting from that. So I'm curious how Big Stone 2 is involved.
Representative Knuth, that was a big question in the certificate of need proceeding. And the answer from both the CapEx Utilities and the Midwest ISO is those were two independent transmission plans. The Big Stone plant could have gone forth with its transmission plan using non-Brookings transmission and not needed Brookings, and Brookings could have gone forward without the Big Stone transmission. And the in terms of going forth with the cap with Brookings, we're trying to get over cost allocation. The outcome of Big Stone will have no effect on us going ahead.
Representative.
And so will Will Big Stone 2 be using the Brookings line, or will they be building their own line?
They will be building their own lines. Not to oversimplify it, in the flow of electrons, some electrons go on all lines. But Big Stone will be, if it built, will build its own transmission lines.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To either testifier, a moment ago we heard about the Group 5, I think, that are locked in negotiations now over who's going to pay and how much. Just a hypothetical question. If the proposed rate division and structure is such that all of the Group 5 people said, we can't make this work, and they all stopped, would the Brookings line proceed at that point?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Ms. McCartan.
Unless we know how the cost of that project will get allocated amongst transmission users and also have an answer to those utilities who paid to build the line or paid to use the line can get their costs recovered, we can't go forward with constructing that. Now, I think that means we have to have a solution. And I think that Brookings is such an important project. We will get a solution. The question is, how quickly can we get there? And if we can stay on course with the timeline we set for ourselves and don't have a delay in starting construction, we could have that line in service by 2013.
Okay, I think that's enough for now.
Okay.
There's other public policy questions, but they're not for her. They're probably for us to ruminate on among ourselves. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Westrom has a question.
Madam Chair, to either witness, the first phase of the Fargo to Monticello route, I understand, is St. Cloud to Monticello being applied for, but that's going to have significant impact on the routing of the St. Cloud to Moorhead phase. What is the status of that? Is the DOT acquiescing at all, or are they still dug in the trench that they don't want transmission lines along interstate highway easement corridors? What's the status of that, and how do we all but assure that that becomes the route of most desirability, and maybe where's the status? Where are things at with the St. Cloud to Monticello phase one of that project? A lot in this question, but I want to get nailed down on that because I think our committee needs to be tuned into this issue because it's got far-reaching effects if we don't focus on this now.
Madam Chair and Representative Westrom, first a quick status on where those regulatory proceedings are with the route. The route application for the segment from Monticello to St. Cloud has been filed, and the wheels are turning on that, so that will begin shortly. The route application for the St. Cloud to Fargo area, second segment of that project, that will shortly be filed in the state of Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier, the routing proceeding is the place where all the information needs to come together with respect to impacts, with respect to agency needs and requirements, the trade-off of all of that. MnDOT has been very engaged in a variety of working groups throughout the up and down the length of that Fargo project. They've provided a lot of input about what their perspective is, what their needs are, and we're looking forward to MnDOT being a full party to the routing proceedings so that their issues with respect to how a transmission line should be sited relative to, say, the interstate can be factored in with all of the other issues with other route options and the trade-offs between those two. I don't want to prejudge the outcome of the routing proceeding because it is so thorough and it's where so much information comes together. I think the important thing is that all of the state agencies who ultimately have good information and necessary information in those proceedings fully participate. So when the PUC makes a decision and designates a route, they can do so with the full information available to them. So I guess I'm not trying to dodge your question. I just don't want to prejudge the outcome of a regulatory proceeding that has just begun. The looking at different routes along the interstate is part of what's being presented in the route application, as well as some routes that don't go along the interstate. And then you can also look at how close to the interstate, what are the impacts, what are the trade-offs. All of that will come together in the routing proceeding.
Okay, and Representative Westrom, there is a meeting that MnDOT has notified us of that they are calling regarding this issue about the right-of-way. And I know that there are representatives of MnDOT here that are monitoring the meeting for that purpose also.
Madam Chair, I just saw notice of that last week. Is that one later this month or early October?
It's in a couple of weeks, I think. I don't know the exact date.
Okay, to maybe follow up, Madam Chair, to the witness, I guess I'm not content with your answer. I guess maybe my question should be more, what is being done? It seems to me DOT needs to be a willing partner to be part of the hearings rather than be adversarial, which is what I'm hearing they are right now, a bit of the tail wagging the dog. What are you doing to make sure that their objections may be able to be met, or we as other elected officials need to impress upon them that there's other considerations and they're not the only one running the show here? Ultimately, it seems to me you and them should be going to the PUC with a way to make that happen rather than them being adversarial and arguing to the PUC this route should not be considered, which then means it comes through all my farmers' fields and cuts up a whole new parcel of land. And if you want to repeat the 70s and early 80s, I think you're on track to do that from the reactions I've gotten from people in the last 2 months, and I don't think we want to do that. So I'm trying to impress upon you, and hopefully if the DOT is here, they understand it needs to be hopefully something going on so you can not be adversarials in this process, because you will not be up by 2013. Well, that's not already proposed, but you won't be up by targeted date. I can rest assured that guarantee to you because of the number of calls I've received in the last 2 months, and this is just the beginning. So,
Representative Westrom, I think that's probably a hard question to answer because they are discussing it, and that meeting will be October 13th. We are working very hard to see that we are able to use those right-of-ways.
Very good, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, excuse me, Representative Westrom, should I respond or attempt to respond to?
What you can, you're sure welcome to.
I guess I'd just like to reiterate that we have reached out to MnDOT. MnDOT has engaged in the working groups that have been taking place. I mentioned earlier all of the working groups and the analysis to try to get all the information that ought to be at hand and before the PUC for them to decide, make the best decision they can about a route. MnDOT's been engaged with that. They've highlighted what some of their issues are. We've tried to respond to that so that we can define route options that provide the PUC, indeed, options to review during the proceeding. And I'm hopeful, as I'm ever hopeful, that we will work together. All of that information will be in the routing proceeding, and that the PUC will be able to come to a good outcome and designate a route that we can build on and that properly balances impacts to landowners and customers' needs and state agencies' needs.
Madam Chair, not to belabor this, just
Representative
follow
Mr.
up. If you could get us as a commission and myself and our staff just information on costs. I know the 94 route is shorter than the other one, but is it more expensive than going the alternative route or vice versa? If you could get us some of those information, that information before the October 13th meeting, I think that would be helpful for us going forward into that meeting.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative, we certainly will follow up with that information. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And our final speakers are Carol Overland and Bev White. Oh, I'm sorry, Bev Top. I have the wrong name.
Joyce Osborne is with me. Beth Topp isn't here.
Yeah, Joyce Osborne is UCAN, United Citizens Action Network.
Okay.
She's here with me.
Joyce Osborne is the name?
Osborne.
Okay.
United Citizens Action Network. We're interveners.
I'll let you introduce yourselves when you speak, okay?
I'm Carol Overland, a utility regulatory attorney. At this point, I am now representing... Bev is here. I'm representing No CapEx 2020, and with me is Joyce Osborne, who is the United Citizens Action Network. I've been representing landowners right on the scene for 15 years now, as of November. And what I think is important, I mean, you have your own presentation, right? Okay. You know, Minnesota does have a rich history of landowner issues in transmission, as were referred to earlier. And also, though, as your co-chair Hilty has said many times, there's a lot of unexamined assumptions that we're dealing with here. And these questions about need that keep coming up, it's really disturbing to have gone through this CapEx proceeding and knowing that demand has decreased so dramatically that we're even talking about this now. I can't believe it. I have, in your packets, you've got an exhibit that shows the decreased demand. XL demand has gone down over 11% from 2007 to 2008. In 2009, it's gone down another 2.2% or so. Year to date, it's, I think, about 2%. But we're talking about a 15% decrease in consumption. CapEx was predicated on a 2.49% increase. The studies were done in 2004 and a little bit in 2005. So we need to look at this unexamined assumption of we need it, we need it, we need it, because we don't. And Representative Beard's questions about do these RES requirements address ramping down, shutting down some coal plants. You know, you'll know CapEx starts in North Dakota, Antelope Valley, where there are coal plants. Those coal plants could be closed down right now, and a lot of wind generation put online with what's there now. And that's the most important thing to come out of here is look at the need. Look at the demand. It has gone down, down, down. And I've included references there for SEC filings. And I don't think that Xcel would be misrepresenting their demand in their SEC filings. The links are all there. I'll send you all copies. You could just click the link, make it easy, and read it for yourself. You can read their conference calls about their earnings. This is public information. And one of the things that I was asked to present on is what types of things we're going to be bringing up in the appeal, because we're definitely going to be appealing this. And number one is demand. There's no demand. We did an offer of proof asking the judge to take a look at this, because the information came out while this was proceeding. So in November, we did an offer of proof. The judge said, no, I'm going to send that on to the commission. The commission did not address it either. So this is something we will be appealing. The second thing will be the big picture. Because throughout this proceeding, it was always, this is a Minnesota line, you know, project. And it's not. It's North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin's in there, too. And we need to address that. And so we will be appealing that. Because just after the decision came out, then it was revealed that, yes, indeed, we do have the North Dakota and South Dakota parts from the coal fields, and we have the extension from La Crosse going to Madison. So that's the second issue we'll appeal. The third, environmental review was hopelessly inadequate. The environmental review here, the state is charged with working with other agencies, and particularly the feds, if there's going to be a big project. This is a monumentally big project. And we submitted comments that there was going to be an RUS review, Rural Utility Service.
Which project are you referring to?
I'm referring to the entire CapEx Certificate of Need, which is the three, which is Fargo to, that's actually Antelope Valley, to the northwestern part of the metro area, and then the Brookings line going across, and then from Hampton down to La Crosse. The larger picture, which you'll see in your handout.
So the three in the southern part of the state.
Correct, the three. We're not really talking about the Bemidji or Grand Rapids part. But the environmental review on that, they did no coordination with the federal agency. and they did virtually nothing on it. It was nominal. It was horribly inadequate. But yet, that's the Department of Commerce. You know that. So that's part and parcel with that.
Do you have any evidence of that or any examples?
I have a record full of it, and it will be in our appeal. If you'd like it, I'll be happy to send you everything. It's in our motion for reconsideration. The environmental report was nominal. It didn't address so many of the really basic things that need to be addressed. I can't say that enough. This has been a recurrent problem since the transfer from the Environmental Quality Board over to the Department of Commerce. It's a repeat problem, and that means it needs legislative help. It's not a problem that's going to be solved in the agency. So you asked, this is what CapEx is. I have a chart for all of you. Goes on and on, a big, long list of this is what CapEx is. CapEx is not within the boundaries of Minnesota. CapEx starts in the coal fields and goes east. So you can see the very specific parts of it all listed here. This is from their documents. They've listed it in their application, in their Appendix A, in their testimony. It's headed, this is CapEx. And you have maps showing what that looks like on the top. One map starting in the coalfields of the Dakotas going east. You also have a JCSP map, but they have a better map of that. It's showing you the bigger picture of what we're talking about here. CapEx is a first step, but we're looking at a systemic change in how we do transmission. Again, the difference between the new and the old. Specifically regarding the demand, I have a chart here of their demand from their SEC filings. Take a look at it, please. The high was in 2006, 9,859. That was their peak. This is from Excel. In 2007, 9,427. In 2008, 8,697. So if you do the math, I'm a math idiot. But if you do the math and take 9,859 and subtract 8,697 from that, you're looking at roughly 1,200 megawatts. The peak demand has gone down. That does not even include 2009. So you could shut down Prairie Island tomorrow. Or you could shut down a couple of coal plants. And you could replace that with renewable energy as needed. That could be done right now. And this is some of these totally baseless assumptions that are being made. And so we need to examine these assumptions about need. Take a look at that. Start shutting down some of these plants. It can be done, and it should be done. And you specifically asked, I was specifically asked to put together what can the legislature do. And the first thing that the legislature can do, repeal 117.189. That's a statute that is a serious problem for landowners. It exempts public service corporations from many of the requirements of state law that everyone else has to comply with. That's got to happen. It happened incrementally. The appraisal limit has been changed, but the sections of that statute, like things that they're exempt from, awards of appraisal fees, appraisal limits, minimum compensation, compensating people for loss of a going concern, those are the kinds of things that utilities are exempt from. That's not fair. So repeal 117.189. That's simple. The other thing has to be happening is mandate. With you've got your RES standards saying so and so much is being has to be renewable. Well, have a reduction in the coal the same that mirrors that, so that you're not instead adding surplus onto what's already there's a surplus in generation. Demand has dropped way down. We have to be shutting these down. That's something the legislature can and should do. The next most important thing is repeal the 2005 transmission omnibus bill. That bill gave them everything that they wanted. And I have many sections listed in this report. The most important things, though, that would change is the transmission to support renewables. That should be repealed because they're calling everything for renewables when it's not. You asked about Big Stone and its connection. The Brookings line has a line that goes up to Granite Falls, where the Big Stone transmission will be its own. Well, that's because it's Big Stone line to nowhere. It's a line about this long going from Big Stone to Granite Falls. At Granite Falls, it connects into the line, connects into CapEx, and goes on out. the testimony in the Big Stone case, and I just had a difficult time listening to this when they were testifying, because the testimony in the Big Stone case, Mark Rogelstad of Otter Tail Power said on the record, under oath, that the Brookings line will carry generation from Big Stone 1, Big Stone 2, and about 700 maybe megawatts of wind.
Okay. Representative Beard has a question.
Just an observation here, Madam Chair and members. I'm looking at Exhibit C here on XL shrinking demand. I see a consistent decrease from 2006, and I'm wondering about the confidence in those numbers. And I'll tell you why I ask. I wasn't going to say anything until you made the outrageous statement that we could take Prairie Island, just shut it down right now. And I'm standing here thinking, and what would that world look like?
Right. Let's think about it.
Let's, because on, remember back in June when we had our heat wave for the summer, mm-hmm. when it was in the 90s, I think it was 3 days long this year. Mm-hmm. The dew point was in the 70s, and we were under the effect of a what they call a blocking high. There was no wind. Mm-hmm. I called a friend of mine at XL and said, tell me what your dispatch board looks like today. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I knew you'd be calling. Yep. He said, at this moment, he said, we're burning everything we can burn. We're turning everything we can turn. Mm-hmm. He said, we're a little over 9,000 megawatts just on the XL system that he was dispatching that day. He said, you'll also be interested to know that we're sending 1,500 megawatts to the Buffalo Ridge, sending power to the ridge, because all of those little windmills become load centers when that happens. I'm sorry, 1.5 megawatts. They're sending 1.5 megawatts to the ridge, not 50. Because all those computers and air conditioners and electric brakes and everything have to hold the machine still and get ready for the wind to come back up. Those were three really hot days when I really appreciated having Prairie Island turning as fast as it could turn. And, unfortunately, the hybrid burning as much gas as it could burn. And Blue Lake, just down the street from my house, running all 450 megawatts to keep up with what wasn't coming from the Buffalo Ridge, whether there's a power line there or not. Just an observation here that you're showing 8,697 as a 2008 peak load, and I'm telling you, in 2009, we've already been over 9,000. And I have a hunch we've been there a couple times. And none of that was our renewable mandate stepping up to the plate to help us out, Ms. Overland.
May I respond?
When sure, Representative Beard is completed.
Well, and then I just have an observation where we may agree on the Brookings line, but perhaps not. But, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make that observation that statements like that, I think, damage the credibility of a witness who I think does have something to say here and does have some concerns that we share. But XL Energy is burning everything they can burn on those days, and they're not turning wind. We're sending wind. We're sending electricity to the wind just to keep the things on standby so that when the wind does start to pick up, we can bring it back online and we can put it back into the mix through something like the CapEx 2020 line from Brookings. Well, just the other observation, then I'll yield to the witness, Madam Chair. There was a comment made that this CapEx 2020 is not just about Minnesota, like somehow that's taking us by surprise. I think I was the author of one of those pieces of legislation back in 2005 or 6, and I was never under the assumption that this was about Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I think I saw this as a regional deal. Whether I like it or not, I see which way the wind's blowing. That's a pun. And it's going to require the infrastructure to change to this new market that's not about marketplace demand, but is about public policy that people have agreed to. The people of this state and this region have elected people like me to sit around here and decide that we're going to have this much renewable power. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to change the infrastructure. So the people we charge with changing the infrastructure and taking care of it, like a couple of the witnesses who were just sitting here a few moments ago, have to come to us and tell us how they're going to make that work. We may have a difference of opinion from an engineering perspective there, Ms. Overland, but I just want you to know that at least speaking for this legislator, I was never under the illusion that this was about Minnesota. I always knew it was about the entire MISO group.
Ms. Overland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Beard, during the proceeding, I'm referring to the Certificate of Need proceeding, and that's where that was a constant issue, and that no, this is not about North Dakota, and this is not about Minnesota. And so that was a constant issue, and I agree. I fully agree. We all knew it was much more than just Minnesota. We knew that. And when I made the comment about Prairie Island, I'm referring to megawatt numbers. And, you know, wind needs backup. I mean, that is a problem. We have a variability problem. And typically wind does not follow the peak. Mm-hmm. Solar does. But we'd need to have, like what happened in Delaware, and the Delaware PSC did a great, they rejected coal gasification. And they had a level playing field competition between coal gasification, wind, and what was the other, gas. And they instead ordered a wind-gas combo so that when the wind isn't blowing, you have the gas backup. And so then that would deal with that problem. And so my point is, though, so if we don't talk about specific megawatts or specific plants, we do need to start shutting down these noxious facilities that aren't needed. And when you say 9,000, well, it was 9,859 was our ultimate peak in 2006. So say, you know, there's 500 megawatts there of wiggle room. You know, what can we do in starting to programmatically change? And that can be done. And now is the perfect time to do it because the demand isn't there. And I remember we were doing CapEx hearings at that time, the RUS hearings. And I remember Tim Carlsgaard, who I know, there he is, was saying, our demand is up, our demand is up. And, you know, I had the chart. And so I remember that day well. And yet the numbers weren't that great. And the numbers weren't in the 2006 line, were they? They weren't. So this is something that we do need to look at. We have an opportunity here because the demand has dropped so much that we can choose our generation. We're at a policy point. You know, we're looking at building $2 billion in infrastructure. Is that the right thing to be doing? We need to be looking at that, and we need to do it now.
Okay.
That's it. Ms. Topp?
Thank you. I'm going to talk about exemptions to the eminent domain law today, but before I do that, I just have one comment to what Carol said. I have some things I want to pass out to you when I'm done talking. One of them is an article written about the 10 Eastern Seaboard governors who went on record as saying, we don't want your long-distance energy. If you send long-distance energy from the Midwest, what that's going to do is stop our locally beneficially renewable energy on a local basis, and that's one of them. So please take a look at that. First of all, I would like to thank you. I'm Bev Topp, and I'm from Lakeville, Minnesota, a citizen in the area of the Brookings Line. I'd like to thank all of you people here who sit at this table, and I know you've got a hard job deciding what kind of energy should be used in Minnesota, who it's going to benefit, and whether or not that means you're also going to allow out-of-state and out-of-country corporations that realize large profits that will only marginally benefit Minnesota and significantly diminish our possibility of developing our own local economically beneficial energy. I'd like to talk about the eminent domain laws changes that were passed in 2006 that went a long way to protect citizens and give them a fair deal for their land in eminent domain cases. However, as you know, the public service corporations were exempted by 117.189, and that does include electric utilities, like the CapEx utilities. Groups opposed to these lines are working very hard to ensure that they do not take advantage of Minnesota ratepayers and property owners while bringing little benefit to our state and much potential to slow down the development of our own local energy, renewable energy. CapEx is asking thousands of landowners to host these questionable lines to endure permanently a viewscape of 170-foot high towers every 600 to 900 feet, to live permanently with their constant noise, and to live dangerously close to electromagnetic frequency that the World Health Organization has determined to raise the incidence of leukemia in children. And then, by leaving Minnesota Statute 117.189 in place, we're forcing them to suffer the supreme injustice of having to turn over their property too without fair compensation. Although a couple of the exemptions have been modified, as Carol talked about, the appraisal reimbursements, and I believe also the year before there was some modification to utilities having to show landowners their appraisal. their appraisals, which they don't have to do under these exemptions. There are still some pretty important things in place that are going to highly affect landowners, like 117.031. While landowners are protected from unjust low offers from units of government in cases of $25,000 or more, they have no such protection from utility offers. Regardless of the percentage of difference between a utility's initial offer and the final awarded judgment, they will not be reimbursed for attorney fees, even when the difference is 40% or more. And in this case, with the transmission lines, I think we should also look at the $25,000 minimum, because that's going to exclude an awful lot of property owners who are going to be set up for an unfair negotiation process. So I believe that needs to be looked at. As Carol talked about, 186 provides for the compensation for loss of a going concern if a business is destroyed in the eminent domain process, and up to 3 years of gross income for damages to a business of 51% of driveway access that is lost. Utilities are exempted from this provision, and it also exempts them from providing minimum compensation sufficient for the owner to purchase a comparable property in the community. There are more exemptions, but I will not go into them right now for the sake of time. But I'd like to point out that when bad offers are made with no landowner protections for the eminent domain process, the road to a fair and just resolution for them is long and arduous and expensive, with no recovery of costs under the present exemptions to the law. I've talked to a couple of citizens who are still going through the nightmare on the Mincan pipeline project for the South Metro area, and each step of the way for them costs more and more money for appraisals and attorney fees with no hope for recovery under the present law. This is just not fair. I've heard it said the electric companies will treat landowners fairly, regardless of the Minnesota laws on eminent domain. But I'd like to point out a 2007 article in the Farmington Independent, and I will be giving you a copy of that, that raises strong questions about that assertion. The article reports on a group of Farmington citizens battling Great River Energy for more than a year, trying to get adequate compensation for land taken to construct a 115-kilovolt power line across portions of their property. Mediation finally awarded these landowners $55,000. That is a 376% increase over the original offer of $14,600. But because of the utility exemptions to the Minnesota eminent domain laws, even if these landowners won GRE's appeal to the mediation decision, which they did, they appealed this, much of the increase they realize goes to attorney fees and to appraisal fees. There are many questions around the need case for CapEx 2020 transmission. And as time passes, it looks like more and more of this project does little to satisfy Minnesota's RES standards, and CapEx is attempting to remove PUC wind conditions put on the Brookings line right now. And the concerns are that these lines are more than a conduit for transporting energy from the Dakotas east to Madison. That concern has been proven recently, but I know we've already covered that. These are not from Minnesota. In the upcoming legislative session, you have an opportunity to right an egregious wrong and to create a level playing field for landowners who are asked to turn over their properties for the alleged greater good of the people of Minnesota. Please do not fail them by leaving the present exemptions for public service corporations in place. In the future, many more of your constituents will become these affected landowners and will be expecting justice when asked to sacrifice for the greater good. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. Maybe this would be for Ms. Overland. On your Exhibit C, you have a statement regarding the need, which I think is very perceptive, your comments about need here. But you say with regard to the decline at peak demand, this does not include the 1.5% mandate to conserve. I happen to think that 1.5% is low, but that's what we have in statute. What would this graph look like if you had included conservation in it? I mean, or how much less need or less demand do we have if conservation is included?
Ms.
Well,
Overland.
One way to approach that, in the Monticello proceeding a couple of years ago, the OES found, or Commerce, found that demand was going up by like 1.4%. And, well, if you have a mandated 1.5% decrease, you'd end up with minus 0.1. So if you're looking at it's going down 11% over 2 years, then you'd be looking at down another 3%. So you're looking at 14% right there. If they're saying that, you know, year-to-date sales are down 2.2%, but that's sales, not, you know, peak demand. But so if you're looking at subtracting 1.5%, that would at least negate any kind of growth. But now we're in a downward spiral, so it's just going to go further and further down. I have a hard time, given the projections that I've seen, 1.5% would take care of any kind of demand, historical demand. And now it's just going to be that much further down. Also, when you're looking at cost allocation, I need to throw this in. There was a Seventh Circuit opinion that's really important on cost allocation. And the a FERC decision to attribute costs to Illinois instead of the mid-Atlantic area where the transmission lines were being built, that was thrown out. So I think that you should all know that I'll send it out to you, the Seventh Circuit opinion. But there will be cost allocation issues of what you cannot do, and they're wanting to, you know, shift the cost elsewhere. Shifting the cost elsewhere has its bounds, and so it's going to be kind of hard to ship costs to people who are not going to receive any benefit from transmission lines. I will send that decision around.
Ms. Overland, I'm curious about your comments that the Brookings line isn't necessary with the decrease in consumption. But we've had plenty of testimony about all the wind projects that are ready to go online mm-hmm. in that area and that they have no other options mm-hmm. for their distribution. So how would you account for that?
Okay, well, first, I don't think I said that the Brookings line wasn't needed. I think they're all not needed, but I didn't specifically address that.
But so when you none of them are needed then.
Right,
so how would you account for any of these wind projects coming online?
Right, and what I would do is, I mean, that's where, the way I would account for that, I would look at it's the last page of my comment about what the legislature really needs to do, is to do a study to look at, like, what the impact of that 1.5% is, what the impact of siting wind near the gas plants would be, what the impact would be if you shut down, say, 600 megawatts of Big Stone and built wind there, what the impacts would be if you need to really look at that. If they didn't build Big Stone and instead built wind, what could you fit on the line? If you have Antelope Valley up there in northern Dakota, there's also hydro up there. What if you had hydro backup with wind and got rid of the coal plants? What would that do to the existing system? What would you need? Because when you're talking about transmission, I mean, we have this absolutely odd notion that's unfounded that we need it. We need it. We're going to freeze in the dark in an incubator without a job. There's no basis for that.
Thank you.
So if we go through these steps.
Okay,
well, if we just look at these steps, that's how I would answer that. This is what needs to be done, these 10 steps.
Okay.
Look at need.
Ms. Osborne?
Oh, I'm just an individual that went through this MinCan pipeline. Started in 2006, and I still have not been paid, and we're coming into 2010. There's a lot of issues regarding a lot of property owners' rights, and Bev touched on a lot of these things. The biggest issue is that we no longer have a voice, and so we have to come to you to give us our voice. We don't have any rights as landowners, and we need some of those back. So I appreciate you listening to us and appreciate whatever you could do, and that's the end of it. Thank you.
Madam You're Chair. Talking about a gas line that was put in?
Crude oil pipeline.
Oh, and CapEx, though, too.
Yeah.
After that.
We're not even paid for from MinCan, and now we've got a CapEx coming through Scott County.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to assure the last two people that through your representatives, or if they bring forth legislation or suggestions on redoing appraisal procedures and award procedures and sharing of documents, et cetera, you will get a sympathetic ear. I think we do and should review that. We did that extensively, as you noted, with MnDOT, DNR, and others that do public appraisals. I'm an appraiser, for disclosure, and I've done right-of-way and eminent domain appraisal work. And so I understand what you're talking about. And there's some appraiser issues on that, too, on how they get paid and when they get paid and by who they get paid. So I'm interested in it. You do have a sympathetic ear. I want you to know you didn't come here
Thank
in vain.
You.
We are listening, and there are some of us, even though it's a specialty, that understand that. What you're talking about, and certainly I think it behooves the legislature to review that. I wasn't aware there was some exemptions carved out, and there must have been some reasoning for that at the time, but I think it certainly merits review, and we should take a look at it again.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. And,
most of that weekend, we'll be back until the
15th. I think we're done.
Andy was talking about the 16th. Get back on 16th is a Friday. Okay. 19th is a Monday. 19th.
Madam Chair, I have one other question I'd like to ask.
Ms. Osborne.
This was brought before the Senate and the House in 08 and in February, March, or whatever, of 09. And nothing has happened. We had authors on the bills in both the House and the Senate, and it just didn't go anywhere. And so we really need some help out here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I do apologize for the meeting going over. I will work on running a smoother ship in the future. Representative Hilty states that we will have our next LEC meeting on the 19th of October. What day of the week is that?
It's a Monday.
On a Monday, the 19th of October.
Probably one.
I know.